Pod.
Hello and welcome back to BNSSG Peds Pod. I'm Ruth Bowen. I'm a Bristol GP working for the BNSSG Training Hub, bringing child and young person education to primary care clinicians. Today we're joined by Dr. Dinesh Giri, consultant paediatric endocrinologist, who's here to talk to us about childhood obesity.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me, Ruth.
Thanks for joining us. We know that childhood obesity is growing nationally. More than 50% are bullied. Many struggle with social isolation and mental health issues, not to mention the associated physical medical complications. Can you tell us a bit more about the landscape of obesity in children and young people in the UK at the moment?
Yeah, definitely. Thanks, Ruth, for having me today. Yeah, it's a very important topic that we are going to discuss because obesity, as we all know, has increased significantly in the last decade or two. Currently in the UK, obesity tends to affect 1 in 4 children and is associated with lots of medium to longer term complications such as type 2 diabetes, obstructive sleep apnea, idiopathic intracranial hypertension, liver dysfunction, and also psychological comorbidities, and can also impact the cardiac health in the longer term. So in the UK at the moment, the latest data show that the number of children living with obesity almost doubles from the start of the primary school to the end of the primary school. So the latest data suggests that 1 in 4 children aged 10 to 11 are living with obesity in England, which is a significant concern. And it is estimated about 2.5 million children in England are affected by excess weight or obesity, and out of which nearly 1.2 million children are in the significantly obese category.
Wow, 1 in 4. I had no idea it was quite that high. That's quite shocking. And has that changed at all post-pandemic?
I think the pandemic has had a definite impact on the rise in BMI and rise in the prevalence of the obesity because of the lack of routine that was missing for a while. So we have definitely seen an increase in the number of referrals from primary care colleagues and also across different other health professionals post-pandemic.
Thank you. So today we're just going to go through 3 cases to guide management at different tier levels.
Sure.
The first case. Mum presents with 2.5-year-old Phoebe to ask advice around her fussy eating. Mum says that she used to eat anything she was offered since she started weaning, but over the last year she's become fussy with her eating and is refusing most vegetables. Mum's worried about her going to bed hungry, so usually resorts to breadsticks, biscuits, packet snacks and juice. Phoebe's BMI has increased from the 25th centile in her first year to between the 75th and 91st. Height is on the 50th centile. What else would you want to know about Phoebe?
For me, I think as a paediatric endocrinologist, the first thing I would always think about is whether the cause of weight gain is nutritional or non-nutritional. I think there are different pointers in the history that might suggest whether weight gain has probably got a nutritional cause or non-nutritional. Most of the weight gain we see around or because of nutritional causes, but there are rare scenarios where one has to think about a non-nutritional causes of weight gain. In this case, Phoebe is on the 50th centile for a height, between 75th to 95th centile for a weight. So if we have a feeling that Phoebe's also been growing in terms of the height, along with an increase in weight, then that is a bit more reassuring, saying that there's less likely, for example, an endocrine involvement. If you have a child whose height is very slow and has not grown for a long time but has put on significant amount of weight gain, then that should ring some alarm bells, whether we need to look out, for example, thyroid issues or pituitary issues or other rare causes of increased weight gain. But most of the time, with nutritional cause of weight gain, we tend to have a tall child where height is not a concern, with also weight increasing over many months. So that's the first thing I would do. Other things such as explore whether the weight has had an impact on the other health of the child. We have to gauge about parental concern. In this case, I think the parents are concerned, which makes things much easier. However, I think in many cases, we find that health professionals are a bit more concerned by the parents' perspective or different. So it's probably useful to start with the level of the parental concern about the weight and then to explore the other impact the weight may have had on the general health. So for example, it's useful to ask whether there's any history of snoring or any disturbances in the sleep or short pauses when the child is sleeping, being very tired in the morning, and other things such as family history of type 2 diabetes, family history of similar weight problem happening at a younger age, family history of blood pressure, cardiovascular diseases, the social history, whether there has been any social concerns within the family, life events. For example, the parents may have split recently. That could have triggered their weight gain because of change in the lifestyle that can happen as a consequence to that. So when we examine any child with concerns about increased weight, look at distribution of the body fat or adiposity. Normally, when you're thinking about nutritional obesity, which is the most common cause of obesity, we would normally expect the adiposity to be generalized rather than a central distribution of fat, which will be more concerning. So, for example, if you have thin arms and thin legs, but then weight is predominantly concentrated on the central adiposity, then that might be a cause of concern. And things like, for example, Cushing syndrome, where you can have some distinctive facies or features, and skin changes such as acanthosis nigricans, which can be found on the back of the neck, arms, or on the back of the knuckles, or cubital fossa on the elbow regions. Those might be helpful to assess if there is any insulin resistance as a result of the weight. So these are the preliminary information that might be useful.
I must admit, I do find it difficult looking at the distribution of fat in children. Even normal toddlers have that delightful egg-shaped belly, so you'd be looking at the arms and the legs and using that as a reference point, would you?
Yeah, the two main things. One is the growth, the doxology. If they've got a proportionally increasing height and the weight, then it's very unlikely there is endocrinopathy or any other rare forms of obesity around. And also, yeah, if you have a predominantly central adiposity with a peripheral sparing, then most of the time in those scenarios, you will get a stunted growth as well. So that probably would want us to investigate if there's any endocrine issues underlying.
Okay, thank you. So definitely important with these children then to have their growth charts and be plotting their heights as well as weights and see the changes over time.
That will be very useful, yeah.
Thank you. It can be very difficult broaching the topic of weight. Do you have any tips or strategies for us in primary care?
We are a little bit lucky in our clinics because by the time the patient comes to the care of childhood obesity clinic, they know that they are being referred for weight-related issues. So I think broaching that topic is a bit easier. So the parents do expect that, and the letter goes before they come to the clinic. We send information about what the clinic is and what they expect. What I might suggest, as we talked about the Red Book, might be very useful, because when we talk to parents, for example, a child coming with asthma and we're finding this child's weight is concerning, but one of the useful ways is showing the parents the Red Book and saying, oh, this is Phoebe's height, which is on the 50th centile, which means she's average, she's growing really well. However, the weight is on the 91st centile, for example. We would expect weight and height to be more or less proportionate, and she's a little bit over. So I think that probably puts some perspective or sort of raising awareness in the parent's mind, and also giving some visual cue as to where the child should be and where the child is now, without sounding stigmatizing about their weight. I think I found the habit of showing the growth chart and going through with them useful in those scenarios. And also, I think things like tending to avoid terms such as obesity at that stage, using terminology such as a healthy weight, you're aiming for a healthy weight between, for example, 25th to 50th centile, is much more acceptable.
Positive reframing, shifting to what you want to work towards rather than them feeling like you're judging them.
Correct. Even in our clinic, we have found in the rare scenarios of using term obesity, I think people have found that to be a bit offensive and people have become upset about that. Using terms such as healthy weight and being a bit non-judgmental helps as well. Yeah, but then showing the growth chart really puts some perspective about how the child is currently and where the child should be. So that I found useful in my clinics as well.
That sounds like a really useful strategy. Growth charts are great in that they're objective, which is really helpful if we're trying to come across as non-judgmental. How would you want us to be managing Phoebe in primary care? Is there anywhere we ought to be signposting the family to for support?
Considering her age, she's quite young, so she might benefit from regular health visitor checkups, monitoring weight. And also, we tend to give leaflets about healthy eating. And I don't think there'll be a dietitian at this stage, but I think health visitor input and giving some leaflets about healthy eating should be sufficient at this stage. But if the weight tends to increase beyond that, then we got to think about signposting to, for example, tier 2 service such as busybodies.
In terms of specific leaflets, there are some really good ones out there. So for fussy eating, NHS.uk has one called Fussy Eaters, and Beezy's Bodies has top tips to tackle fussy eating. More general leaflets with strategies for managing overweight children. There's Change for Life and Liv Well's advice for parents of overweight children.
Those are very useful for the parents to understand their weight of the child and also have some tips and pointers about what can we do. So for instance, things like, for example, we've had a child not long ago who was a bit younger than this baby, 14 or 15 months, came to the clinic with increasing weight gain. But then we found that mum was giving 5-6 bottles of full-fat milk every day. So things were like swapping the milk from full-fat to semi-skim or reducing the amount of bottles. I mean, those things significantly helped the child. And when we saw them 6 months down the line, the weight was significantly better. So those tips and pointers can be obtained from these leaflets and also having general chat with the health visitor.
Fantastic. Thank you. So our second case, 7-year-old Matilda presents with her parents, who report that over the last year they've noticed that she stops breathing for several seconds at a time at night, sleeps with her mouth open, snores, complains of headaches, has ongoing frequent nocturnal enuresis, and is cranky before school. She's been overweight since birth. Her BMI today is on the 96th centile. How would you approach this case?
This is a 7-year-old girl with concerns about breathing. As we discussed in the last case, this is something we always tend to explore in the history. This is concerning because she's only 7 and she's got some concerns that suggest you of obstructive sleep apnea. In this age group, we also have to think about things such as tonsillar and adenoid enlargement. And therefore, it's important to look at tonsillar enlargement. If there is one, then it might be useful to refer to the ENT for a possible adenoid tonsillectomy. Other things in the history such as has been overweight since birth. And that is a concerning thing that needs a bit more exploration. Because although it is very rare, we do come across genetic forms of obesity. If we have a rapidly increasing weight under the age of 3, or perhaps even under the age of 5, then we think about whether there could be genetic or monogenic etiology for their weight. Now, I think in the current scenario, there are specific genetic testing available for children with early onset obesity. So that might be something we'll have to think about, because an early onset obesity is also a trigger for referral. Apart from this, in this scenario, the reason for headaches could be because either this child is retaining a lot of carbon dioxide because of the obstruction in blowing it out, or because of pauses in the breathing that's happening, the child is getting not enough sleep and therefore wakes up in the morning tired and then has headaches and things. Further exploration, examining for the ENT and appropriately referring to ENT specialist or a respiratory specialist who can decide upon doing a detailed sleep study to look at whether there is any disordered sleep breathing. Looks like she's got a potential complication related to weight. And the BMI is also concerning. The weight can help to reverse the complication, which means that she probably needs to have more support.
Thank you. So alongside the ENT or respiratory referral, is there any plan that you would want the primary care clinician to put in place?
While the child is waiting to be seen by a respiratory specialist or ENT, this family can be signposted to, for instance, busybodies, where they can help and point us towards healthy weight. So the busybodies are a charity service. Predominantly, it is a group of healthy weight nurses that do. They would fix a number of sessions face-to-face with the family, tips about healthy eating, cooking tips, and also they do engage other children in regular physical activities, which are quite enjoyable. I'm not sure how many sessions they do.
12, I believe.
12 sessions, yeah. Many young people and their family have found it very useful. At the end of the session, they found that the weight has significantly gone up, then that would automatically trigger a referral to their tier 3 services. Or if the child has had complications in the first place, then they would trigger a referral to the tier 3 weight management services.
Busybodies is Bristol specific, but I believe that there are very similar programmes across the country, such as Health Weight Programme in South Gloucestershire.
Correct.
Thanks. So Matilda presented with symptoms of obstructive sleep apnea. Are there any other complications of obesity that we should be assessing for?
Yeah, things like type 2 diabetes is one of the significant complications. So polyuria, polydipsia, or any signs of insulin resistance such as acanthosis nigricans. Although it's rare, we do get patients with idiopathic intracranial hypertension. There's a complication of excess weight. So a headache that is constant, or early morning headaches, headaches associated with vomiting or visual disturbances. And those should prompt for urgent referral to an ophthalmologist to see if there's signs of any raise intracranial pressure, and if it is, then they usually get referred to neurologist for a lumbar puncture and further assessment. Liver dysfunction is not very obvious from symptoms. If we are able to do some blood tests in the primary care, and if the child has got increasing ALT, which is a marker of fatty liver disease, so that might be a helpful pointer in identifying a complication of excess weight early. Mm. If we identify any complication, then that would trigger the appropriate referral pathway.
Thank you. The third case. 13-year-old Ravi presents with his mum. The whole family struggle with weight and were engaging as a family with tier 2 support for the last 2 years in Southampton. Ravi's weight has continued to creep up and his BMI today is 41. Mum has polycystic ovaries and has just started a statin for dyslipidemia. Dad's on ramipril for hypertension and had type 2 diabetes diagnosed when he was 39. Mum's looking to continue family support locally. What else would you want to know about Ravi?
Thank you, Ruth, for bringing this case, because this is exactly the type of patients that we see in our tier 3 weight management services. So there is a significant concerning family history. BMI is very high, 41. Mum has got polycystic ovarian disease and is on statin for dyslipidemia, and dad has got hypertension and type 2 diabetes as well. So this child is at very high risk of developing complications related to excess weight. In the clinic, this patient is seen by doctors, by dietitian, by the psychologist, and has MDT approach. From the medical point of view, what we would like to know is whether Ravi has got any complications at all. Things like acanthosis nigricans, what his HbA1c is, whether he's got any symptoms suggestive of sleep disordered breathing, whether he's got any symptoms suggestive of idiopathic intracranial hypertension, type 2 diabetes, and how this weight has affected his mental health. Prolonged school absences, bullying at school, how quality of life has been affected by his weight. So we have a number of tools in the clinic in determining that. We have evaluated quality of life questionnaires. And a dietitian will go through what forms a routine diet for Ravi, what he eats for breakfast, lunch and evening, and what sort of snacks he has. And then the dietitian will be able to form a plan about cutting the calories or even calorie-restricted diet. The psychologist will want to know the mental health impact.
Fantastic, thank you. It's great to hear it's such an MDT. I didn't realise there was a psychologist there as well.
They have a very significant role. The other thing, a patient like Ravi, who is 13-year-old, with a significant BMI and also quite a strong family history, on the top of doing the MDT assessment, we have also moved towards giving pharmacological treatment for severe obesity. So more recently, GLP-1 analog have become available and also licensed to be used in young people more than 12 years of age. And we have been using that quite a bit in our cohort, found to be very useful, especially in the cases where the obesity is very severe and associated with complications. We have seen very good results with the use of the medications along with the MDT. We always have to remember these medications are only an adjunct. Mm-hmm. The main thing would be the lifestyle and the dietetic management, and this medication can be added on, which then helps them to lose weight and lose weight in a good fashion, potentially also reverse some of those complications.
Great, thank you. And what are your referral criteria for the Tier 3 Care of Childhood Obesity clinics?
Because of large waiting list, we have agreed on a national referral criteria. So the BMI standard deviation score of more than 3.3, or having a BMI of more than 99.6 centile with a obesity-related comorbidity, or a child with a significant safeguarding issue due to obesity, or very rapid onset obesity, or a suspicion of genetic form of obesity, or if you suspect endocrinopathy causing weight, like for example, if you're suspecting a Cushing syndrome, those sort of things are referral criteria to the services.
Brilliant. And then just honing in a little bit on the genetic cause there, what sort of things specifically we should we be looking out for? So we've talked about family history already and rapid onset at a young age. Is there anything else that should make us suspicious?
So I think the rapid onset obesity less than 5 years, and the obesity has been there for a long time since the child was born. History of hyperphagia, this component is not easy to assess. The child has had a meal, but then the child is asking immediately for a same or bigger portion immediately following that. And then I think eating non-food items, for example, raw chicken or not food-related items. We have seen children eating chalks, paper, because of the hunger. Mm. That gives us an idea whether it's a pathological hunger. they can be associated with significant neurodiversity problems and things like that. So those are the things that would make us think the underlying cause could be genetic. Although it's very rare, I would say probably less than 5% of the children will have a genetic cause of the weight gain. But the red flags are very early onset of obesity, less than 5 years of age. Mm-hmm. And then the obesity being there since the child was born, a significant history of hyperphagia.
What are your wait times like at the moment?
Unfortunately, it's about 10 to 12 months.
So in the meantime, whilst these patients are waiting, is there anything you'd like us to be doing in primary care to support these patients?
Signposting them to the resources that we discussed before. And then also, I think we are in the process of designing a website with some resources added on as well.
Brilliant. And would you want us to be doing any investigations in the meantime? So would you be wanting us to do fasting glucose, LFTs, lipids, or just wait for your clinic?
No, I think it would be really helpful because we tend to check these blood tests at their first appointment, a fasting blood glucose, HbA1c, because there's a significant family history of diabetes and PCOS. If possible, a fasting lipid profile would be helpful. Thyroid function test, a liver function test. These are the five main things. Given the wait time of 10 to 12 months, it will be useful if the patient has got this done. And for instance, the HbA1c comes back as high, then that would automatically trigger his referral to a diabetes clinic. A referral to a diabetes clinic is much more rapid. Having those sort of information helps us as well.
Thank you. And are there any key resources you'd like to discuss that we haven't mentioned already?
Yes, our team has worked on an e-learning resource, which is now freely available on the Health Education England e-learning platform. This is to support professionals working with children and young people with obesity, and it's an online training that covers causes of childhood obesity, relationship between obesity and mental health, physical and social complications of obesity, and provides an overview of evidence-based lifestyle changes. Crucially, this training also highlights the importance of non-stigmatizing communication and designing compassionate services to help reduce weight. It also highlights solutions, use a family-based, person-based approach, and supporting the behaviors from parents and the rest of the family. I think it's a very useful resource to look at, and it's freely available on the Health Education England website as a e-learning source.
Fantastic. I'll link that under this podcast. And can you expand on that at all? What are the family-based strategies?
It is about understanding the dynamics in the family. The trigger for the obesity could be, apart from the ultra-processed food and not healthy food, there could be other family dynamics that might be contributing to obesity. For example, parents split, or there are other significant social difficulties going on in the family. So understanding the family dynamics is very important. And in our service, we're quite lucky to have a psychologist, and we also have a social worker who can go more into detail about these family dynamics and how to help them. Our social worker is very skilled in identifying these dynamics. If there is extra support that needs to be given to the family, the psychologist is helpful. Apart from understanding the dynamics in the family, they also spend a lot of time understanding the relationship between the food and the child or the young people. Most of the time, we find a non-hunger eating to be a predominant cause. For example, a non-hunger eating can be triggered because of stress or depression. Unless we address that, it's unlikely that there'll be a big change in the BMI. So the psychologist helps to give some strategies that can be used to alter the relationship between the food and the young patient, and to distract the mind from a non-hunger eating. Things like mindfulness when you're eating, not seeing television when you're eating. There are lots of things that our psychologist works on.
That's fascinating. And really useful, actually, thinking about the underlying cause. There's a lot to unpick with childhood obesity.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Thank you. And what are your key take-home messages for primary care clinicians?
I think at the primary care, you see patients for other reasons, but then you come across concerning weight. In those situations, it might be helpful to broach this topic of obesity in a gentle fashion. When it's a gentle fashion, maybe in a non-judgmental way, and also perhaps not using the terms obesity, but terms like healthy weight, and addressing that with the family, showing them the red book, talking through where you expect the child's weight to be and where it is now. So that might be helpful. And then pointing them to resources, depending upon the weight. If we have a child with a significant BMI, then it might be useful to do some screening test, as we discussed before, to screen for any complications. And if there are any complications, then that would trigger the appropriate referral pathway.
Thank you. I think for me, a few of those key take-home messages are that staggering statistic of 1 in 4. I had no idea that obesity in children and young people was anything like as prevalent as that. I really like that way of broaching the topic with families with using the growth charts. It's quite a nice objective manner, so you can positively reframe towards this is a healthy weight we would want them to be walking towards. That's a really nice way of doing it, so I'll definitely be using that. It's really helpful having those red flags around genetic causes for obesity. So thinking about hyperphagia, rapid onset, very young onset. And great knowing a bit more about the tier 3 services and quite the variety you have in the MDT. I had no idea that you had a psychologist and a social worker and quite the value of their input.
Tier 3 services in Bristol has been running for a long time, but more recently, you probably may have heard about the Q Clinics, which is the complication of excess weight clinics. That is a National Health Service, NHSE commissioned national service, and that's been there for the last 3 years. I think they've commissioned about 21 centres across England, Bristol being one of them. The primary aim of the clinic is to resource this MDT in order to look after children with severe obesity living with complications. And I think because that sort of clinic is now available in other parts of the country as well, there is a place that they can refer these children. But previously, 3 years ago, there was no service at all existing for children living with severe obesity. But now, with this commissioning of the Q services, there are some centers that GPs or even the secondary care colleagues can refer children or young people living with severe obesity.
Brilliant. A well-needed service, particularly the way things are going.
Absolutely, yeah.
Fantastic. Thanks so much.
No problem at all. Thank you. Thanks for having me today. Thank you.
The contents of these podcasts are for educational purposes, aimed at primary care healthcare professionals only. They do not substitute professional medical advice or consultations with healthcare professionals. Information presented is the opinion of the healthcare professional interviewed, based on their interpretation of best practice and guidelines at the time of the interview. It is the listener's responsibility to compare information given with up-to-date national and local guidelines. The BNSSG Training Hub, Ruth Bowen, and interviewees are not liable for any clinical decisions made as a result of this podcast.